Sten, and the website is redeyescreations.com. We're glad to have you with us. Today we have an interesting program about Babylon's banksters, the survival of the Nazi Empire, and the search for the Philosopher's Stone. The Nazi serum, the Soviet mercury, and the American gold are all parts in an alchemical process that we'll talk about today with author Joseph P. Farrell. Joseph was first with us back in 2007 discussing his work. We did two-hour interviews that we of course encourage you to tune into as well. You'll find them in our archives. This is about money. Where do the money go? Where did all that bailout money go? What are they being used for and who is using them? Joseph describes financial blackmail on a massive scale, connecting this with world domination, new weapon developments, and factions of the old Nazi Empire remaining and still pulling strings behind the scenes today. Stay with us for two very interesting hours. All right, welcome back, Joseph P. Farrell, to Red Eyes Radio. It's very good to have you with us. It's been 3 years, I think, 2007, we had you with us last time now, and you've been working and putting out books almost every year since that time. And I mean, when we had you with us last time, we talked about a little bit about the Giza Death Star series. We talked about Reich of the Black Sun, the SSU Brotherhood of the Bell, and also the Cosmic War. But since that time, you've released Secrets of the Unified Field. You've released the Philosopher's Stone. You've released Roswell and the Reich. And also, obviously, the latest one is called Babylon's Banksters. You've been keeping busy. Joseph, tell us a little bit about your latest book, and if there's any connection to that one, Babylon's Banksters, in terms of some of the previous books that you've been writing, as I see as a kind of a series, if you will.
Well, thanks for having me back on, Henrik. And you're right. All of my books are intentionally conceived to be interconnected. Even the ancient books with the Nazi series and vice versa, because the real story that I'm getting at here in all of these books is that there is a kind of hidden or off-the-books physics that once lay behind the achievements of ancient civilizations, and I think to a certain extent motivated some of the mystery schools and secret societies and fraternities and so on that were preserving this knowledge, although I grant the proposition that they were doing so probably without knowing the full implications of it. Mm-hmm. But this is the real intention of my books. I plot out books about, I'd say 3 to 4 books in advance of the book I'm actually writing on at any given moment. So in other words, they all fall into kind of a predetermined order within an arch of books that exists, at least in my own mind. But the books that you mentioned on the air now, Philosopher's Stone and Babylon's Banksters, those were definitely conceived as kind of a subunit within that arch, because what I'm trying to do is show the relationship between basic concepts in alchemy and certain concepts within modern physics. And additionally, what I begin to do in Babylon's Banksters is explore what I call the post-war activity of the elites that survive this cosmic war that I wrote a book about. So naturally, some of that activity is centered on finance, and I'm trying to show in that book the relationship between two basic physical models and then two basic financial models, because there is a deep, deep connection that most people don't really appreciate between physics and financial policy. And this relationship, incidentally, is very, very, very old. So if we look at what's going on in the world today, you know, I know that Europe is certainly having its problems, certainly the United States is having its problems. But we need to understand that the action of the political elites is largely the product of very hidden manipulations of what I'm calling the elites that survived this cosmic war. And essentially their game plan has not changed for millennia.
Well, it couldn't be more timely as well, obviously, considering that, you know, as you alluded to, the situation that the, you know, most of the world anyway is going through financially right now. Was the worst of this latest incarnation of the economic situation that we're in beginning to unfold, you know, before you decided to write about this, or did you start the project much earlier than that?
Well, it's a bit half of one and six dozen of the other, you know. It's a little bit of both. I had the idea to do this kind of book about 4 to 5 years ago. In other words, it was one of the books I had plotted out in my Arch of Books back when I was writing SS Brotherhood of the Bell and then Secrets of the Unified Field, because what got me on to thinking about that, Henrik, was that in studying so much of what the Nazis were doing with their physics, it occurred to me that they were doing the same thing with their financial and monetary policy. In other words, they were creating basically an open systems set of financial rules, in that they had basically, under Hitler, had thrown out private monopoly central banking and its control over German currency. So in other words, they essentially returned to the same system of money that this country had under the 13 colonies, of states issuing money directly, debt-free, into circulation based on the surplus of goods and services within the national gross domestic product, which is, incidentally, what real money has always been.
Exactly.
You know, if we don't learn this one lesson, if we do not learn this one lesson, we will never, ever advance any further beyond this constant dialectical polarization within our political systems. And I don't care what the country is. It exists in every country in Europe. It exists in every country in North America and in Latin America. So in other words, if we do not understand that the game that bankers have played and pursued with great success through the millennia is to gain control of the issuance of a state's money. And when they do this, Henrik, we must understand that banks cannot really issue money at all. They can only loan money into circulation. Mm. In other words, they create principal, but they never create the money in circulation to pay off the interest on the principal. So in other words, the game is always such that there's never enough money in circulation to pay off a national debt, and debt under that system can only increase.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to me that Nazi Germany pursued this policy of state-issued money under Hitler. It's interesting to me that the communist Chinese do it today. It is interesting to me that this was the system of money in use in this country prior to the American Revolution. Each of the 13 colonies basically issued its own currency.
Mm-hmm.
But if you study American history, and most Americans, Henrik, don't even know this aspect of their history.
Right.
But if you study American history back in the colonial period, under that system, we had virtually full employment and very, very little inflation. And we had tremendous prosperity. And then, of course, the Bank of England stepped in and shut it all down.
<You know>? Yeah, right.
So what happened out of that was, of course, the American Revolution.
Yeah.
So it had a tremendous effect on our nation's history, but it's an aspect of history that has, in my opinion, been deliberately suppressed in history books within this country. But if you look at the history of most nations in the world, certainly in Europe, you find similar things going on. You have very clear assertions of the sovereignty of the crown to issue the currency of the state, but eventually bankers get their hands on a monopoly charter from various crown heads within the various states of Europe and start issuing monetized debt rather than real money.
Yeah.
Because again, a bank cannot issue real money. It can only loan money. So this is the problem I think that we're faced with, and it goes directly to, in turn, to the reason that I think we are faced with the environmental situation that we're faced with, because if you have a closed system of finance, in other words, if you have a system that is being advocated by these banksters, and let's call them that because they are a mix of your local banker and then, you know, a criminal underground gangster.
Yes,
you know?
Absolutely.
They're a parasitic class, you know, and I don't care if you stand on the left or the right politically, this is exactly what they are. Yeah. They're perfectly willing to play both sides of
That's
the
right.
political game. But if you pursue that financial policy, by the same token, you are going to want to suppress any development within physics that will lead to renewable energy sources. In other words, the game is always scarcity with these people. And they call scarcity under a variety of euphemistic names, you know, sustained growth and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
but the bottom line is that these are the people that do not want to see the open release either of physical theories that will lead to a technology of renewable energy sources, and by the same token, these are the same people that are behind the suppression of so many, many inventors. I know that you have a ton of them there in Europe that have come up with some amazing inventions, and you know, they are decried and derided by scientists because their inventions defy the models of physics that the bankers themselves are promoting.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a deep connection, Henrik, between this financial policy and the policies of energy and physics that we see going on.
Well,
and this is the point I'm trying to get at.
And I want to ask you here then, because obviously your interest in Nazi Germany, National Socialist Germany, has
yes.
you know, is in one way at the core of this obvious as well. If we touch upon this that you alluded to, that the banksters are using both sides, you know, the political spectrum in order to manipulate things and make things happen in terms of events and stuff like that. We can see maybe even tying in First and Second World War to how the banksters in many cases financed Hitler on one side, and then obviously those bankers were behind the Allies, if you will, as well. If we read some of
yes.
you know, Anthony Sutton's work, for instance,
yes.
We can see that, you know, Hitler was financed by a lot of, you know, the New York bankers and stuff like that as well. So it must have been after this period that, you know, when the Nazi war machine was built up in many cases by Western money, it must have been after that point then he started to issue their own money over there in Germany. Is that how things unfolded, or how did he regain that control again for that short
period
of time?
This is an excellent question. Basically, Hitler began this policy almost as soon as he took power, and he did it very cleverly. He did not go directly against the power of the German Reichsbank. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Excuse me. What he did was he did essentially the same thing that President Kennedy would do in 1963. And that is, rather than openly abolish or challenge the Federal Reserve, or in Hitler's case, the Reichsbank, what he did was he set up a parallel currency, essentially, that was denominated in Reichsmarks that were called labor treasury certificates. Now, for all intents and purposes, what these things were simply paper currency issued against the goods and services of the state, and they were used to pay people, you know, that were building the autobahns and so on and so forth around Germany, you know, building up the infrastructure of the country that was part of Hitler's version of the New Deal. You know, he called it the Arbeitsschlacht,
And
battle for work.
And exactly, and this was done in order to help to save the economy or rebuild it up again,
yes.
give people work, but in the meantime, obviously, the industry that they were working for was the war industry. But go ahead, Joseph.
Yes. Well, yes, this is precisely so. So in other words, what he did, you know, is essentially he turned his back, or he betrayed the very bankers that put him into power, because he knew full well the monetary system and situation that they were really that they were essentially after trying to mortgage the entire nation of Germany.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And in a certain sense, you know, I'm not trying to condone the crimes or anything of the regime, but in a certain sense, it was the only rational course that any sound or sane German government could really follow. And, you know, he took direct issue and direct aim at the power of the bankers by doing this. And so quickly, I think, to their shock, so quickly solidified his power. And then, of course, by the end of June of 1940, he's overrun most of Western Europe.
Yeah.
You know, this presents a bit of a problem.
So, that's right.
And the same thing, you know, in World War I, I think you have to look at the activity of these banksters in fomenting the Russian Revolution.
Yes.
You know, I do not talk about this in my book, but since you mentioned World War I, it's good to remember that you had the heavy involvement of major banking houses on both sides of the conflict in World War I, maneuvering and scheming, essentially, to get the Bolshevik leaders inside of Russia so that they could foment a revolution. On the American side of this activity, you had the banking houses of Kuhn Loeb and so on and so forth,
yeah,
that actually funded Trotsky. And on the German side, you had the advisor to Kaiser Wilhelm, who happened to be, guess who, Paul Warburg, who, you know, his nephew was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
So yeah.
In other words, you have a coordinated activity getting Lenin through German lines into Russia and Trotsky from America over to Russia, and it's all being done by these banksters.
Yeah.
And the net result was, of course, the Bolsheviks assumed power. They sued for peace with the Germans, which really, you know, at that point in time, there was little else they could do anyway. And that made that massive shift of German troops from the Eastern Front to the Western Front in 1918 that very, very nearly shattered the Allies. That made all of that possible. So again, you know, this is a huge story. And I wanna add, if I may, Henrik, to your question, the post-war activity of these people after World War II.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have another book out that's called The Nazi International, in which I attempt to show that not only did Nazism survive World War II, but it survived as a powerful, organized political entity, kind of an extraterritorial state, if you will,
mm-hmm.
with vast financial resources, with a vast network of contacts and intelligence agents and so on, and that it survived well enough that it continued independently to research its wartime secret projects. So in other words, we're dealing with a very powerful organization.
Oh, yeah.
Well, at the beginning of Babylon's banksters, excuse me, I got to take a little swig of water.
Oh, go ahead.
But at the beginning of Babylon's banksters, I point out that people have often wondered what, in the name of sense, the Bilderberg group really is for. You know, you get the standard line that it's so the elite can meet together and plot world domination, which is probably true. You know, I have no difficulty with that. But if you look at the historical circumstances under which it was formed and who was doing it, on the Anglo-American elite side, you have, of course, the Rockefellers, you have the Rothschilds involved in the formation of this thing. But on the European side, who do you have? You have Prince Bernhard,
yes.
of the Netherlands.
And now Beatrix,
and of course,
have taken over that role now since he passed away.
Right, exactly. Well, Prince Bernhard was actually German, and a German nobleman, and had been an SS officer. He had been in senior management in IG Farben.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
And, you know, if you stop and consider what this symbolism actually means or portends for the purposes of the Bilderberg Group, I think what it means is this, is you had all of this huge amount of liquid capital assets that the Nazis were sitting on top of, hordes of gold, platinum, diamonds, you know, paper currency, and so on and so forth, that they literally had to move and launder. And on the other hand, the bankers of London and New York had the means to do it. So in other words, I think that the real purpose of the Bilderberg Group was to coordinate the post-war financial activity of this surviving Nazi International with the Anglo-American elite. But I've said something over and over, Henrik, when I've talked about this subject, and it's very important for people to know.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, I believe that, most definitely Martin Bormann survived World War II. I do not believe that he was a secret Soviet agent and any of this. This man was a Nazi.
Okay,
But, you know, he was a kind of a second-generation Nazi in that he was the professional bureaucrat version of, you know, the Hitlers and the Goerings and the Goebbels and so on and so forth. This man was a capable organizer. And when you're dealing with Martin Bormann, you know, and I say this very directly to the Rockefeller and Rothschild crowd, when you're dealing with the likes of Martin Bormann, you're dealing with Dick Cheney, but without the warmth and charm. And when he moves all of that money into your banks, sooner or later, that marker is going to come due. And if you cannot pay up when the call is put out, here's the bad news. They're researching the technologies to pull the trigger if you can't or don't pay up. I think, Henrik, in all honesty, that we are looking at something like this scenario with the recent meltdown financially.
Okay.
I think this is exactly what we're looking at, because I cannot speak to Europe's situation. But in this country, of course, we had these ridiculous bailout hearings in Congress and literally spent billions to bail these people out.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I use the analogy of an electrical circuit. If you put electrical energy into a circuit, it's got to go somewhere. Okay?
Yeah.
But we are not seeing show up anywhere in the world where all of this money went. And when they called for no oversight in Congress for this money, to me, Henrik, that sounds like someone being blackmailed, you know, wanting to get a bunch of money from the government agents because they've got a, you know, a gun pointed to their head and they've been told not to involve the government people.
Okay.
The behavior, in other words, to me, was very, very suspicious. It did not sound right. It did not sound correct. There was a gun of some sort being held to these people's heads. And the only thing that I can see in the record historically where you have a big enough gun that could put that kind of pressure and would be willing to use its technological muscle in displays of that technology if you couldn't or wouldn't pay up, the only people I can think of in the historical record is this group of post-war Nazis. I'm not saying that this is definitely the case behind this scenario, but I think it is a strong possibility.
So a blackmail of sorts have potentially occurred against many of the governments around the world.
Yes.
You need to pay up. Otherwise, you know, we have the technology and the means to make bad things happen to you. That's what you're saying here.
That's what I'm saying. And I'm saying it not so much with the governments of the world, but rather with the hidden banking elite behind them. You know, I think that there's basically a within the Western world, I think you basically have a European continental elite with very strong ties to this Nazi International. And then on the other hand, you have what I call the Anglo-American elite, which of course would be represented by the familiar banking houses, you know, Barclays and Lloyd's and Chase Manhattan and so on and so forth, and all the families associated with them. But I think that's the people that were being targeted, is this Anglo-American elite. And again, I certainly include some possibility that there was some Chinese economic warfare going on there as well. Because, you know, if we look at communist China, Henrik, we're dealing essentially not so much with a communist state, but with a national socialist state.
Right.
Because it is, you know, it's not the Soviet style of international communism that you see there, and it is a communism that has obviously made a great deal of room for the private sector. So
yes.
In other words, this looks to me much more like Nazism or fascism in the traditional sense than it does communism.
Yeah. That's
so, yeah.
That's right. okay, there are many questions here, obviously, that arise because of the statements that you've made here. First of all, I would think that if these, you know, people who were behind the buildup of the Nazi regime helped them financially, then to me that would imply that they are kind of working together in one way, if you will. It would imply to me that they are under the control of the financiers. But you turn it on its head and mention that this rogue group or you know, the elite, the cream of the crop, so to speak, of the Nazi establishment have persevered. They've gone elsewhere. Possibly we can talk about that later too. You know, South America, or maybe even set up somewhere in China. Then, but they've managed to set things up, so to speak, and are continuing, their efforts or doing whatever they're doing. But this hold that I'm talking about then from the financiers is not there. Mm-hmm. Because I see the relationship of these groups being very close. But how do you explain that?
Well, I view it in the following way. You do have two elites. You know, I'm not saying that there's two and only two elites in the world, but for the purposes of our scenario, these are the two that we're focused on.
Yeah.
What I'm maintaining is really that you had a post-war detente that was struck. In other words, their goals on each side are the same. They want to dominate the world, and if I may cite Martin Bormann himself here, he wanted to create a post-war European federation, which Germany would be able to dominate by what he called elastic political means. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
He learned to speak the lingo of the New World Order very well, okay, and he knew how the game was played.
Right.
But he was sitting on top of this huge amount of liquid cash assets that he could move into these Western banks in return for a pledge to work together and for common goals and certain things. I think what we're seeing, in other words, is as they approach the end game, the alliances and tensions within all of these factions are breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
And these banksters were very, very cleverly, in my opinion, set up by a Chinese economist, and I talk about him in the book, by the name of Dr. David Lee, with his formula for coupling credit swaps,
mm-hmm.
okay, which
mm-hmm.
led to this current meltdown. I think they were very carefully set up by the Chinese and whoever else was involved with them in doing this. And the result is that we are witnessing a breakdown of that detente. And if we look, to me it's very, very curious that there is a circumstance that actually tends to a certain extent to corroborate that scenario. Because if you look at certain countries in Europe, they seem to be doing a lot better than we are.
Yeah, well, that's true. Certain countries for some reason seem to get away, you know, with this, so to speak, much, much better. And then we have, you know, Greece, who's fallen heavily. Iceland has been really, you know, set back by
devastated.
This, and obviously the States as well. But continue.
Well, yeah, Iceland, Greece, the United Kingdom. Isn't it curious that it's those types of countries that are suffering the most? And yet, you can go south of the Baltic Sea where you are.
Yeah, yeah.
There's one country that doesn't seem to be doing too badly. You know?
Well, I mean,
it's
funny bit with this stuff as well, because although, you know, we can't on the surface see any repercussions of this, but obviously we up here too, we had done our own versions of the bailouts, obviously, as well. And we've,
right.
you know, dumped huge amounts of money into various industries, including banks and things like that as well. And but I also at the same time, I'm wondering, where is this financial, you know, collapse? As you say, in certain countries, it seems to be prominent. In others, not at all. But, okay, go ahead, Joseph.
Well, I think, yeah, all I'm getting at here is I think that we're dealing here with a circumstance that tends to corroborate my scenario.
Mm.
That whatever detente was struck between these two post-war surviving elites, the Nazis on the one hand and the Anglo-American elite on the other, I think we're witnessing the breakdown of that detente, and we're looking at a realignment. It's very visible in the increasing political and policy differences between the European Union and the United States on the one hand.
Mm-hmm.
And we're looking at something else too. that's going on, and I should mention this, and that is the increasing detachment of Japan from the Anglo-American orbit. To me, it was highly significant that the Japanese emperor paid a state visit to China. And if I'm not mistaken, that is the first time in history that that has been done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're looking at that, you're looking at the recent complete political change inside of Japan within the last year and a half with their elections, which essentially threw out that crowd that had been running Japan largely under the aegis of that Anglo-American elite.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at increasing independence of various power blocks around the world from the country that represents that Anglo-American elite, and that's the United States. So, you know, to me, again, this is a signal that this old détente is breaking down. Europe is certainly going a much more independent course than at any time previously since the end of the war.
Hmm.
And you find the same thing around the world with the rest of America's allies. So again, you know, to me, this is all representative of this breakdown.
And it's not only that, you know, the world at large have decided to, you know, slowly kind of demolish or take apart the role that the United States have had after World War II as being, if you will, kind of the world's police, you know, with your, you know, veto in the
right.
UN and all these things. It's been a very powerful nation, obviously, financially,
yes.
industrially and everything. And to me, at least, it seems like the rest of the world have decided now, no nations anymore. We can't have this. If we're going to have a one world government falling into place here, we have to have, you know, we can't have one country that is stronger than others. And,
right.
and that, to me, anyway, would be one of the explanations of why the rest of the world and Europe also, in many cases, then have decided to kind of detach themselves slowly from the States. But what do you make of that, Joseph? What do you think?
Well, again, I don't know. You know, I'm not a political forecaster. I do not know where all of this is going to end up. I suspect that, you know, if the European Union does not achieve a representation in and of itself on the Security Council with a veto, then you're going to find pressure and moves to give Germany a permanent seat with a veto on the Security Council. And in fact, the German government, very quickly after the reunification, began to lobby for that.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it's not something new. It's been going on very, very quietly behind the scenes. But, you know, this is one thing I would expect. You'll either see a seat for the European Union on the Security Council with a veto or, you know, to replace France. I don't see the French as giving up their seat. So I think what you're going to have eventually, you know, maybe within the next 10 to 20 years, you're going to find the Germans being given a permanent seat on the Security Council with a veto to kind of represent the Central and Eastern European interests of the European Union on the Council.
Mm.
Whether or not the UN would go for that, that would give Europe a de facto two-seat presence on the Security Council, and I don't know that the rest of the Security Council will actually accept that. I would think probably not. But you're going to see some real politicking going on if the intention is to extend the role of the UN into an actual governmental body. You're going to see some real intense politicking going on surrounding the Security Council, and I would think particularly Europe's role in it.
Yeah.
This is unavoidable. So a lot, you know, that's kind of a prediction for the future of what to look for if that's the way they decide to go.
Right. Okay, let's zoom out a little bit more here again and
sure.
just ask the bigger question here again. I mean, if we talk about this role group, you know, Babylon's banksters, basically, are then, I guess, and we can also assume that Bormann, you know, is not still alive. Who took
right.
things over? Who has been running the show? Is this part of the people who are involved in the Bilderberg Group, or are we talking about a totally different group here, Joseph?
Well, I think, you know, again, I don't speculate in Babylon's banksters as to who took over the leadership of this post-war international fascist organization. In fact, that's really anybody's guess. There are a lot of books about that particular organization out there, but there's no real consensus among researchers as to where the leadership or leadership council is and who it might be.
Mm-hmm.
There's a consensus only on the fact that it probably exists, all right? But and again, I don't focus on that, Henrik, so much because the real focus of the book is the financial activities in ancient times of yet another post-war elite that survived, you know, what I call the cosmic war, a very, very ancient war. Its focus is on the financial activities of that elite. But if you look at, pardon me, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you as well a little bit about, there was a news article or a report that came out, I think it was a few years ago now, that talked about this idea that Nazi Germany had basically realized that at a certain stage during the Second World War that they were going to lose. And there were certain documents, I think, that were released.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find those as we speak about this now, where they said that basically we're going to go underground, but we're going to financially invest in other corporations and try to regain power throughout Europe again. And even some have even connected the whole plans of the European Union back to this.
Yes.
Is this what you're talking about? Is this the same group you think now?
This is exactly what I'm talking about, because, and I'm so glad you asked that question, because it is one of the central discussion themes in my book, The Nazi International. Basically, if you go back to World War II, what happened, Henrik, in the period from the surrender of the German Sixth Army at Stalingrad in February of 1943, and then the German counteroffensive from March up to, the end of May of 1943. The Russians were quite literally attempting to smash the entire southern wing of the German front, and they not only were unsuccessful, but ultimately colossally so. And that, again, led to kind of a stalemated situation on the Eastern Front.
Yes.
It was during that period that the Nazi leadership, and in particular Martin Bormann, came to the conclusion, especially after Hitler had made it clear that he intended to launch another major offensive on the Eastern Front in July of 1943. The Nazi leadership, particularly the Bormann, came to the conclusion that, you know, the war is lost if we keep doing things this way.
with
all of these unsuccessful offensives.
Yeah.
So Bormann began the organization of a strategic evacuation of German capital assets, of German patents, of technological documents, of German scientific personnel. This was a massive operation, and it's important to understand that the Nazi Party and Martin Bormann himself had at their disposal so-called black boats, black U-boats that were kept off the rolls of the Kriegsmarine and literally turned over directly to the Nazi Party to accomplish this task. Mm-hmm. So in other words, there are U-boats that are not even on the rolls. You can go to Hamburg to the museum there that the German government keeps of all these military records. Well, that's just the Kriegsmarine. It's not the black boats that were operating under the Nazi Party. We don't really know how many they had. We know that they were usually the large cargo-carrying U-boats and so on and so forth. Well, this operation continued right up to the end of the war, and in some cases even after the war.
Yeah, right.
they were just evacuating enormous amounts of this stuff. Then in August of 1944, and I go into this in Nazi International quite a bit, it's a book that really should be read in conjunction with Babylon's Banksters, because it gives you the modern activity as opposed to the ancient activity. But in the Nazi International, I point out that Bormann had a meeting of top German corporate executives that was held at the Hotel Maison Rouge in Strasbourg.
That's right.
And he kind of chaired this meeting from a distance in Berlin. And basically, what the meeting was to do, and the thing that came out of it, was the German corporations were ordered to turn over to the Nazi Party Chancery all of their foreign reserves, all of their liquid assets. In return for this, the party would then take their huge amount of assets and funnel them into these German corporations via a huge network of dummy corporations that Bormann had set up all over the world.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the U.S. Treasury managed to find and shut down 750 of these dummy corporations. That gives you an idea of the size of this operation.
Mm.
But, you know, if you dig and scratch long enough in the American archives, you'll quickly get the impression that this was probably only what we uncovered, or that Bormann allowed us to uncover.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we were barely scratching the surface. So in other words, when you have the Bilderberg meetings begin under Prince Bernhard, what you're looking at is a creation of the mechanism that is going to ultimately create the European Union via all of this huge intertwined financial network that Bormann sets up. And I should point out another interesting thing that I mentioned in Babylon's Banksters. Mm-hmm. One of the early attendees, regular attendees at the Bilderberg meetings was Dr. Hermann Josef Ops, who was, of course, the CEO of Deutsche Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
During the war, however, Dr. Ops was not only on the board of IG Farben, and he was not only a member of the Reichsbank, but he was a member of a small handling bank in Berlin that was actually set up to do nothing but cover the accounts for the German Reich government.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, Dr. Ops was the man signing Hitler's paycheck as chancellor.
Right.
Okay?
I see.
So you have yet another one of these Nazis that was a major player in these early Bilderberg meetings.
Yeah, yeah.
And to me, again, all of this simply means is you have the thing is being set up to move all this Nazi loot into those Allied banks, and then they in turn turn right around and funnel it back into Europe, you know, after they skim off their cut,
right,
to rebuild Europe.
And in a weird kind of way, then, it could be argued that this is money that just have been flowing, if you will, back and forth between these different brotherhoods, and also back and forth between the different banks that these kind of brotherhoods chose to work with at that time.
Yes, exactly.
You know, because we're basically talking about the same type of money. If you know, New York and other banks around the world, British probably as well,
sure,
financed, you know, the Nazi war machine, the build up, and then you have a huge, you know, amount of wealth in Germany at that time, and then before the war, or you know, before the ending of the war, you move out, you know, back that money again to maybe the same banks as well. And that could be another way, obviously, to, as you alluded to previously, that's a way,
sure,
of creating money as well, creating wealth. You move, you know, huge amounts of currencies around the world.
That's
commonplace, you know, so.
Yeah, well, look, yes, that's exactly what we're looking at, because what happens, these banks, by getting access to these funds, what happens, Henrik, is they can keep these funds more or less off the books, all right?
Mm-hmm.
But by having such a large liquid reserve, they can expand their ledger credit-making entry ability tremendously.
Right.
So in other words, this, to my mind, is what really accounts for the tremendous post-war expansion of credit from these major banking houses after the war, beginning precisely at the time of the mid-50s,
mm-hmm,
that you have with these Bilderberg meetings. This is the real reason, I think, that you have this tremendous expansion of credit, because you've got all of this Nazi loot sitting in your vault.
That's right.
And as a consequence of that, you know, you had the tremendous prosperity in this country during the Eisenhower administration, and that really more or less continued right on through the Kennedy administration and even the early years of the Johnson administration in this country. So this tells quite the story. And by the same token, you know, you had the Wirtschaftswunder in Germany after the war with Ludwig Erhard and these finance ministers for the West German government, which again, if you scratch and sniff who these people are, well, Ludwig Erhard, who later became the chancellor and who was one of the early finance ministers of West Germany, well, he worked for Dr. Goebbels' propaganda ministry in a very high position, as did, for that matter, Chancellor Kurt Georg Kiesinger. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you had all of these basically Nazi characters running this so-called economic miracle inside of Germany, but you need look no further than the fact that where is all of this wonderful money coming from? Mm. Why is this dang Deutschmark so stable? Well, it's because there's a huge cash reserve, a huge gold reserve, a huge platinum reserve that's backing all this stuff up, and it's in New York banks, and Martin Bormann is the guy sitting on top of all of this, and you know, you can talk to West German prosecutors from that period of history, and they often went on record as saying there was something very, very peculiar in their attempts to investigate Bormann's whereabouts and presence, you know, using their lender capabilities or the German federal government capabilities.
Yeah.
That they would oftentimes meet this invisible wall of resistance that they could not figure out, you know, where is this pressure not to investigate all of this coming from?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I can tell you, it's coming from those Anglo-American banks, and it's coming from the Nazis in Latin America.
Yeah, that's there you go. Well, I mean, that's a good point, because there's so many unanswered questions surrounding World War II and what happened there with,
not
only the money, but everything in terms of people. And I mean, it's incredible that they, you know, got away with it, if you will. But I also just quickly want to mention here that the meeting here that you were talking about at the Maison Rouge Hotel in Strasbourg, apparently on August 10th, 1944, where all this was discussed, has been detailed in something that is called the Red House Report. It's also the U.S. military intelligence have dubbed this report EWPA 128, in case, you know, anyone out there wanna read more about this report. And it's an interesting one, because again, as you emphasize, it basically talks about the Nazis' return to power, you know, and to work for, you know, a strong German empire again, what they would dub in one way the Fourth Reich, but through the European Union, you know, basically.
Yes, so exactly.
That sets a little bit of the framework, obviously, as well, of what we're talking about here. But I guess, you know, this might sound like a stupid question, but what does this group need money for? You know, in one way, if they're so incredibly wealthy in one sense, and potentially, I would say, are controlling a lot of things that are happening behind the scenes. It's almost like if they're involved in these major industries and things like that. What are they trying to finance, do you think, Joseph?
Oh, an excellent question, and let me give a rather strange answer. There was a fellow in Europe that published a book. His name was Heinrich Krüger. In fact, I think he may have been Swedish. I don't know which country he was from, but I think that he was from Sweden.
Right.
And he published a book that was called The Great Heroin Coup, as in the drug. And he details the activities of the criminal underground in the 1970s to entirely restructure the world drug trade. Well, one of the things he also points out in that book is you have the heavy involvement of this international fascist organization in those activities to penetrate the international drug trade and use it as a source of more funds. So back to your question, what do they need all of this money for?
Yeah.
Now, in my opinion, Henrik, if you read the implications of my book, The Nazi International, carefully and closely, what you have going on in Latin America for a period of time after the war is the continuation of certain aspects of the Nazi Bell Project.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
So in other words, what they need all this money for is to fund and finance very advanced black projects research, which they are pursuing independently of any of the post-war victorious allied powers, you know, and that would include the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
What they're attempting to do is, I think, set up a source of permanent funding for their black projects, for their black operations, you know, all of this stuff, for their international terrorism efforts. You know, this is the other big thing that we need to bear in mind about this post-war group of Nazis that I talk about in Babylon's Banksters and Nazi International, because these are the people that had the funding, the intelligence organization, and the actual organization itself to carry out these activities after the war.
Mm-hmm.
If you scratch and sniff long enough, you're ultimately going to find yourself dealing with people like Otto Skorzeny in nationalist Spain. And again, it is this organization that sponsored and hosted many of those international terrorist summits in the 60s and 70s. In other words, these things were being hosted by Nazis.
Yeah.
You know? So look further, my friends, than just radical Muslims for these activities, because there's another player involved with them at a much deeper level.
Yeah.
And it, again, goes back to this post-war Nazi international.
See, I for some reason also have... or I can turn around and say and ask you this as a question. Are you of the belief, you know, that some of the world wars were financed in such a way in order to actually destroy German, you know, science? They have, you know, the engineering. They had, you know, huge advances in terms of what they you know were onto in terms of their physics, you know, theoretical science, other aspects as well. Because this goes back to what you alluded to earlier in the interview, when you mentioned that this group of banksters are also interested in basically keeping certain technologies, you know, off the market, so to speak, known to other people. And you know, from your point of view, obviously, you know that the Nazis were involved in some interesting experimentation and science projects, which are potentially just leading to some of these aspects. So how do you connect these two different ideas? That on one hand, they're building up something, you know, which is, you know, exotic technology in one hand. At the same time, they seem to try to destroy the German scientific progress that were happening around the time of the World Wars as well. How do you piece this together, Joseph?
Oh, boy, what an excellent question. And, you know, I have not intentionally addressed that question in any of my books, but it does fall out as an implication, particularly from books like Philosopher's Stone and Babylon's Banksters, Nazi International, and Roswell and the Reich, I would add, into that mix.
Mm-hmm.
To speculate a bit here, off the top of my head, in answer to your question, there has been a group of thought, a school of thought, largely that falls out of the research of Anthony Sutton, the fellow that you mentioned at the beginning of the interview, that World War II was essentially, or rather I should say the Nazi regime, was kind of an experiment that was being run by these bankers as to which form of socialism should we pursue. Do we pursue the international socialism of communism in Soviet Russia? Do we pursue the national socialist version of it in Nazi Germany? Or do we pursue the kind of mild, moderate New Deal socialism of Franklin Roosevelt in the United States of America?
Mm.
And as a result of Hitler's just nothing less than stunning military success by June of 1940, you know, with the fall of France. Well, my word, by this point, you have the Nazis basically in control of the industrial regions of France, certainly in control of the Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, Norway, Western Poland. And then by the end of May of 1941, they're in control of significant portions of Yugoslavia and Greece. They have Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Finland as allies. So in other words, basically by May of 1941, you've got all of Europe under the German jackboot.
That's right.
And the situation for the banksters at that point is they've created a monster, and this man isn't even playing by their own financial rules either. You know, he's funding this vast German war machine basically on debt-free money. So there's just no way you're going to control this thing. You have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
You must put down, you absolutely must put down Germany as a nation. Now, the real interesting aspect of your question is that you're insinuating that the real goal of World War II is to maintain a lock on the technology that clearly is beginning to be implied by the physics papers that were being published in Germany between the wars.
Yes.
And that is clearly, you know, the Allies knew that there was something afoot inside of Nazi Germany along those lines, but they didn't know exactly what, and they figured that, well, probably they're going after the A-bomb, which they did, and which, in my opinion, they actually got.
That's right. But they wanted to go further, even.
Oh, yes, much, much, much further.
Yeah.
You know, we need only look at the fact that the Bell Project was called Kriegsentscheidend, war decisive. Well, you know, that's the only thing in Nazi Germany that ever merited that description. The atom bomb itself did not even do that. So in other words, yeah, the Nazis are pursuing so-called free energy with this device. They're pursuing field propulsion with this device. They're pursuing, you know, if you weaponize this kind of physics, my word, you've made a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker.
Yeah, that's right.
you've got a lock on the ultimate planet dusting doomsday weapon if you want to weaponize this stuff.
I think
you do have to entertain the possibility, to finally answer your question, that you do have to entertain the possibility that part of the goal of this war is to get a lock on whatever it is the Nazis are developing. And, you know, as I pointed out in Nazi International, if you look closely at the division of the spoils and who is doing it, it's the Nazis themselves driving who gets what. They make very sure, Henrik, that the Soviet Union and the Western Bloc get roughly an equal division of the spoils precisely in order to create a post-war stalemate and deadlock. And on top of this, you turn over that whole Nazi military intelligence unit, Fremde Herde Ost, under General Galen, that was active inside of Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union during the war. Well, you turn that over lock, stock, and barrel to the United States, and that ultimately becomes the Soviet operational desk of the CIA. So in other words, by the time the CIA is created in 1947, you have nothing but a house of Nazi spies under the front of the CIA, and here's the bad news, folks. The day-to-day operational control of that organization remains in the hands of the very same German general that ran it during World War II. And to me, this is the only explanation you need for the 1948 panic in the United States. Oh my word, the Soviets are about ready to overrun Western Europe at any moment. Because the military assessment of Soviet capabilities and intentions came from where? It came from General Galen's network.
Yeah.
So in other words, I think, Henrik, you had the Nazis not only driving a technological stalemate after the war, but you had them further increasing the East-West tension by dint of these intelligence analyses and estimates that they're probably feeding to both sides.
That's interesting.
And why is that necessary? Well, you need only study the history of German diplomacy since the era of Frederick the Great. They are constantly, just because of their geopolitical position, they are constantly having to play off East against West to give Germany maneuvering room in the middle. And that's precisely what happened after World War II. And you know, as I point out in the Nazi International, when the Berlin Wall came down on November 9th, you know, well, that's the anniversary not only of Kristallnacht in Nazi Germany, but that's also the anniversary of the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923.
Right.
So, you know, this didn't come down by accident. It happened on significant Nazi anniversaries. It was a coordinated activity. And if you look at the moves of the German government under Chancellor Kohl at the time, Germany moved quickly and almost unilaterally, and over the objections of the United Kingdom of the United States, to recognize Croatia, to stimulate and then recognize a breakaway Bohemian government that's now called the Czech Republic, to break up all of these nations that were created as a result of the Treaty of Versailles. And Henrik, you can sit down and read these moves and your jaw will just drop, because you're looking at 1938 revisited. It's,
yes.
You know, this is all right out of Adolf Hitler's playbook.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, you have all of this activity going on over there in Europe, largely, you know, by dint of the German government, and it never even gets onto the radar screen of the news.
No, that's right. Oh, yeah, that's what that's the struggle here, obviously, and that's why I appreciate people like yourselves who are doing this kind of research and connecting some of these dots and digging up this material, because it's very, very interesting in listening to these, you know, alternative theories, and in most cases, it makes a whole lot more sense than the official, you know, statements. And in most other cases, you don't even get any kind of a comment on these things or what happened, or you hear a little bit here and there in the news about it, but obviously the big
right.
connections are never made, you know? So,
right.
Joseph, why don't we do like this? Let's begin to, you know, just run up here the first hour, talk a little bit about the books you have out there and those who are upcoming, mention
uh-huh.
your website and stuff like that as well.
Sure.
You talked about the Nazi International. That is not out yet, is it? That's the one you're writing.
Oh no, that book came out in 2008.
It did.
That book is already out. Yeah, that came out after Secrets of the Unified Field. It came out right about the time that Philosopher's Stone did.
Got it.
You're
putting out so many books. I can't keep track of them.
Well, I've got two different publishers now, and. I've got two different publishers, so that may be one reason it's kind of hard to track. But yeah, if people want to know what books I've got out, they can go on Amazon and then just Google my name, and it'll pull up my books, the books that are out now. I've got I just came out. The last book that I had that came out is a book called Roswell and the Reich,
yes.
which is. A very different interpretation of Roswell. It really has the UFO community so upset they don't even want to talk about the book.
Okay, that sounds interesting. Yeah,
I did have one unfavorable review from Stanton Friedman that really didn't address any of the points made that I made in the book.
Okay.
rather assiduously avoided them, but but as far as I'm concerned, that tells me I pretty well hit the target on the bullseye, but that book came out earlier this year. I have another book at the printer right now called LBJ and the Conspiracy to Kill Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
and then the subtitle of that is A Coalescence of Interests, and what I do in that book should be coming out, I'd say, early next year, probably even January. That book is really an examination not so much of the conspiracy, but of the structure of it.
Okay.
Hmm. Who's doing what and why.
Okay.
The other book that is coming out next year is a book called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And that, again, is a kind of a continuation in that ancient arch of series of books dealing with the activities of the post-cosmic war elite and what they're up to and why. And I'm writing another book right now that will continue that aspect of the story. So, you know, long story short, I really don't remember how many books I have out there anymore. I just write them, you know. I let the publishers worry about, you know, who's handling what. But
That's right.
I think that it's about 11 books. I'm looking at my shelf right now. 3, 6, 9. Yeah, 11 books out there right now.
How about that? Yeah.
Yeah. SS Brotherhood of the Bell is available now in German, Die Brüderschaft der Glocke, and Giza Todesstern is available in Germany right now.
Mm-hmm.
Vrastvo Koloka is the Russian version of SS Brotherhood of the Bell. So, you know, if anybody's listening in Germany or Russia, Some of those titles are out now in Germany and in Russia.
All right. Well, that's excellent. And obviously, then we can urge people to go to Amazon for a full list, I guess, in terms of many of the books that you do have out there. You do have your own website as well, GizaDeathStar.com.
Yes.
And I guess, obviously, you're writing so much that you don't have too much time to update that regularly. Or how are things going with the website, Joseph?
Well, the website, yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm writing so much that basically, you know, I haven't written any articles on the website in probably over a year.
Yeah.
People go on there and continue commenting and discussions of things. But, yeah, I'm writing so much in terms of books. I'm involved with not only writing a book now, but a huge, huge major project I can't even talk about.
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just so busy that I don't have time to post little articles on the website anymore, but it is still up there.
It is there.
Still good.
Yeah.
And if people want to make donations to help the research, there's a PayPal button there. And if they want to contact me, they can contact me by hitting the contact button there, and that'll shoot emails directly to me.
Excellent. Also, obviously, want to mention again here Babylon's Banksters, then we will have links up on our website to Joseph's websites, to many of the books that are available on Amazon as well, Amazon.com as well, so you can get copies of the books, because it's very interesting stuff, and begin at some point. I mean, the whole Giza Death Star series is one aspect in itself, and then we have all this, you know, deep political aspect of the Nazi regime and some of the science that they've been developing, and that kind of book series as well. But let's take a short break here then, Joseph, and then we'll return with more in our next hour.
with Joseph P. Farrell, we get into the area of advanced weaponry and warfare in more detail and discuss what Joseph thinks might have caused the earthquakes in Haiti and in Chile, and also the recent sinkholes in Germany, Guatemala, and in the Amazonas. We also tie in HAARP and talk about the Norway spiral being a result of a demonstration of IceCat, which is Europe's version of HAARP, actually taking down a Russian rocket. We talk about CERN and the massive rotating magnets there and the creation of a torsion field. There's much more going on there that we know about. All of this, of course, is contrary to the standard model of physics, but this is something that possibly the scientists of CERN have tapped into, sending them back again to the drawing boards, because they might have found something out when it comes to the unified field, time dilation, and things of this nature. We discuss what Joseph calls the beginning of the endgame. We tie in the work of Judy Wood on the destruction of the World Trade Center towers on 9/11 with advanced weaponry. This might have been the first steps in the war that now is unfolding between various factions of the powers that are struggling for world domination. Do not miss this second hour. Sign up for membership, try it out for 3 months, get access to all of our archives. It's quick, easy, and you'll get instant access. All the information is available on redicecreations.com. Go there for more of this and many other areas of research and interest.